Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on the top of the crime at the top of their game. Crime Wire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our website is www.crimewiresite.com. Please go visit it. We have an interactive chat room, and we have a whole new look to our site, and we look for your membership and your participation on all these cases nightly and weekly. You can call at any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/crimewire. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future case for a future show, email us, please, at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Gang violence allegedly claimed the life of an innocent victim in Modesto, California at about 1 a.m. on August 24, 2003. 25-year-old Lacey Ferguson was in the wrong place at the wrong time. According to local authorities, Lacey and her boyfriend, John Ritchie, were in a convenience store parking lot located in an area that had experienced gang activity in the past. Suddenly, shots rang out, catching them by surprise. The shooters were in a dark-colored vehicle that cruised slowly through the parking lot. The police believe there were at least two Hispanic males in the car, and that their target was a gangbanger named Adrian Vega. Neither Lacey nor John knew Vega. They just happened to be passing by his car in the parking lot. John and Lacey were both struck by bullets. Wounds were not life-threatening, but Lacey's were fatal. In spite of having several witnesses to the incident, no arrests were made, and the case remains unsolved. And with us tonight to discuss this tragic case is Lacey's mom, Bonnie Driscoll. Bonnie, welcome to Crime Wire.
Well, thank you for having me.
And could you tell us, please, are there any new developments in the case? Anything has changed from what I just read?
The only difference on the things that you read was it actually occurred in the early morning hours of August 23rd.
Okay.
Of 2003.
Still no arrest in
the
case?
Nope. 20 to 40 witnesses, and they all left, and nope. Not a
now,
thing.
Is there a reward in the case? I believe there is, isn't there?
Yes, there is. The governor, we're in California, the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, proclaimed a reward of $25,000 per suspect, which can go up to $100,000.
Okay. And now, with all these witnesses, what do you think is the reason that it would appear on the surface, perhaps, that the police should have been able to identify the perpetrators here, but apparently they haven't been? And is there a problem with the witnesses, or the witnesses won't talk, or what is the deal there?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think being as it was a gang drive-by shooting, a lot of people are afraid of gangs because gangs perpetrate quite a few crimes here in our area. I think a lot of people like to mind their own business. They don't want to be a part of something like that, and I wish they did, but I have my own personal opinions on folks like that, but I wish they would come forward. It would solve Lacey's homicide, but it would sure give our family a lot of ease in the pain that we're suffering.
Bonnie, can I ask you, I didn't see a website on specifically for your daughter with her name in it. Do you have one up someplace?
No, I do not.
You know, we have found here at CrimeWire and in the work that we all do that when you do that specifically, and it's $10 on Google, you put her name in there, or you put Justice for Lacey Ferguson in there, .com, and then you start putting updates and information in, you put the reward money in there. What happens is you might start getting information. You put a Gmail account in there that's specific to that website that you create. I'm sure, Pat Carista, why don't you weigh in? I mean, how important is that to do this?
Well, a website is very important, and a lot of the families that I work with have websites, but you just told me something new about being able to do it on Google and have it under Justice for and the name and a $10 fee?
Yeah, it's $10. You can do Justice with the number 4 or spell it out. Or, you know, we've seen it in a lot of these cases. We've helped a lot of families. Imagine Publicity has helped a lot of families put together not just the website but also a Facebook page, not MySpace. MySpace doesn't seem to be as effective, is it, Vito?
No, not at all. Not compared to what's going on now. No, MySpace is, as the kids would say, it's all played out by now, you know.
I've got to say the same thing. Yeah,
it crawls. The information will crawl every time. You know, every time there's a suspicious death, and you put the word gang and you put specific tag words in there, what will happen is, and we've seen a lot of movement on cold cases like this, where you put it up, and you will get hits. You put a stat, what's called a stat counter, in there. It's free. You put that in there on the website that you create, you'll be able to see who's going there. You know, sometimes with certain hits and different things, you've captured the IP address. Somebody might send you something that would directly correlate with whom was looking at your site. These are important things. You know, you're facilitating the result in finding out who did this. And again, you put the reward money up there. There's a lot of money to offer for a case, and people are hungry. And maybe somebody married somebody. You know, 5 years is a long time. Maybe somebody disclosed something. Maybe somebody will have a guilty conscience and come forward. I mean,
well, we keep praying for that, I'll tell you that. And
you've got a great idea.
We have tried just about everything we can think of, and that's one thing we hadn't thought of, so I'm really grateful that you've come up with this.
That's good.
But it really does crawl. Again, it specifies her and her name and what happened that night.
Right.
Hey, Bonnie?
Well, that's one thing we hadn't done yet, so we will be doing it.
Bonnie?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Vito Colucci here. A couple of things that jump out to me. Now, 7 years has gone by, right, on this case? And it appears to be obviously a gang shooting, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, what usually happens with police departments that continually to do follow-ups, okay, a lot of these people, some of these gangs now, unfortunately, they're dead. Okay, if you have many that have been arrested, there's other ones out there. These gang guys, they change girlfriends every week, okay? And not only that, a lot of them are in jail. So what I would do if I'm still working on the police department and working this case, you know, somebody's in jail, you may be able to go and cut them some kind of a minor deal, depending on how high the charges are, because this is a situation where a lot of people know. This isn't like a one-person thing. That whole gang knows.
No, there's a lot of people know.
Yeah, now, the witnesses are one thing. Obviously, you know, somebody should come forward, but you can't help that. They're scared. It's the neighborhood. But the gang itself, someone's facing some charges, and they want to get help out, whisper a name in my ear. That's all I want. Whisper a name in my ear. Tell me how they did it, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of people. You got ex-girlfriends that now have moved on. You got guys sitting in jail that you go and visit. Hey, weren't you a member of the such-and-such gang? Yeah, you want a little break a little bit? You want to get out a year or two before time? Give us the murderer. You know, so there's a lot of ways to do it, and I wonder if they're doing all of that. You know, do you get updates from the police?
Yes, it's the sheriff's actually, and yes,
okay.
Stanislaus County kind of sheriff. But yes, I speak with them quite often. In fact, I believe I became a pain in their side actually over this because I want answers.
But how important is it for families? Because you deal with families all over the country. How important is it for families to be a pain in the side and let them know that you're still there and vigilant?
You have to. I mean, it's not, you know, you see a few cases that get solved immediately, and which is a good thing, But there's so many others that turn into cold cases that it's incredible the amount. And if you're not proactive, it doesn't get done. And that's a fact. And, you know, it's a terrible fact, but it's a true fact.
Well, make sure you ask them those questions that I just put your way. You know, are they doing that? Are they talking to any of these gang members now, 7 years later? Some of them may be out of the gang, could have a guy or two that has gone straight. You know, all you need is the one. See, all you need is that one piece of information from that one person. People sitting
right.
in jail, Mr. Officer, have you gone and talked to any of these guys that are sitting in jail? Maybe, you know, you cut them, they'll give you a murderer, cut them sentence a little bit.
I have received tips. I always receive tips. I turn them in. I'm told that they're followed, and I'm told that they don't pan out to anything, is what I'm told. And it's like the 17th, 18th convict or prisoner who has come forward and said, oh, I have something on that. And half of them don't even want anything.
Yeah.
You know, and then, of course, there's the others who do, but, you know, but there's a good half of them that don't want anything other than they say clear their conscience.
Yeah, this
you know,
case just seems to be there's a wider group of people that know who did it than a lot of cases.
Well,
that
yeah.
we get. Yep.
This might be a good time to mention, I didn't address this in the introduction, that Bonnie, in addition to continuing to work to get justice for her daughter, has also is the president of Wings of Protection. And this is a victims advocacy group that she co-founded with Susan Levy. And Susan is the mother of Chandra Levy, the intern who was murdered in Washington, D.C. in 2001, and Donna Raley, a stepmother of Dina Raley McCluskey, who went missing in October of 99, and Dina's body was found 8 years later. So the three ladies are all with Wings of Protection. And what they do, in fact, is focus on helping families of victims maintain contact and have with the police department, the investigating agency, and Bonnie will even call the agency involved on behalf of the victim's family if there's maybe some animosity or hard feelings that have developed. Because, as just mentioned, she knows how important it is to have that line of communication open between the victim's family and the investigating agency.
And she's not afraid of it. You know, she knows the lingo, and she knows how to speak to them. And for these families, it's very important because they're angry. And sometimes, Bonnie, and I think that you would agree, when it's not for you and it's for someone else, you take a different position. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a different kind of strength because when it's our own, we don't often step up to the plate in the way that we need to.
Well, it's true. That's true because with a lot of families, it's either fight or flight. And either they fight for justice or they bury it, you know, and try to get on with their lives and I won't say they accept what happened, but to go on with their routine of their daily lives, it's almost, you know, like if it's not, it turns to a cold case or whatever, what are you going to do, you know? But, yeah, we deal with a lot of families on that. We also, with Wings of Protection, we do homicide and missing under suspicious circumstance. So we also handle missing people.
Bonnie, how can people get a hold of you? We were talking before we went on the air, and you indicated that right now as far as any personal, such as visiting a police department or something, that's obviously got to be in your area, but you will talk to people from outside the area by phone. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Would you give
absolutely.
Your email address, and then maybe if someone has some questions for you or would like some assistance, they could get a hold of you?
Sure. The email address we have is nicihaaol3@aol.com. And that will be a direct email address to me where I can handle it personally.
Okay. And would you repeat that one more time in case somebody was slow getting the pencil?
Okay. N is in Nicholas. I, C is in cat. I, H-A-3@AOL.com.
And do you get quite a few families that contact you looking for assistance or looking for advice?
Oh, I can't even count how many families we've already worked with. We just got through working with the family of Sandra Cantu in Tracy, California.
Mm-hmm.
And we handle a lot of different, you know, cases. And, you know, everything from hand-holding all the way through court to whatever. I mean, you know, because they're all individual different circumstances. And it depends what the family needs at that time.
And Pat Caristo, why don't you explain a little bit about what your agency does? I mean, you're a consultant to CrimeWire, but it's important, I think, at this point. Explain a little bit for families what you do.
First, I'd like to ask Bonnie how she came up with the name Wings of Protection. It's a pretty name, and it has many levels of meaning. I wondered what her meaning was.
Actually, I didn't. Susan and Donna did. And they are actually the co-founders. And I met Susan and Donna about 6.5 years ago. And since then, I became president. So this is kind of their baby.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the name. And I think it's a beautiful name. The emblem that goes with it's absolutely stunning. It's the motif is lavender. And it's a little long-haired, red-headed angel in a purple gown.
Okay.
And it's just beautiful.
My company started out as a regular private investigations agency, just doing regular work for profit. And in 1994, I got involved in an unsolved homicide called the Caitlin Arquette case. And as a result of that case, my company became a nonprofit agency because we ended up spending lots of time helping families of unsolved homicides at no cost to them. So Caitlin's case changed lots of people's lives and changed how I do business. And Kate's case is still unsolved after all these years. And yet today there was a response on Facebook from somebody. People still continue to try to give information. And we work on cases actually all over the country. I have one of a unresolved death in Florida, some in New Mexico, all over the country. Sometimes all we do is review the case material, make some recommendations on what other areas might be followed up, make a few calls, similar to what Bonnie says, just be there and take other levels of help. But sometimes people just need to know there's a number to call.
That's right. And Vito, you know, when you're out there and now you're in, you know, you're a private eye, you've got your own agency, but being on the street, do you see gang members, you know, kind of softening after a while and perhaps coming forward in a case like this or in other cases that have information over time? Do they do that?
Well, you know, they want to always appear and say that they would never give information, you know, on that. But you see, when you have so many, like what we're talking about in this case, we're talking about a gang, and it's not like one person in the gang knows that they're going to go do a drive-by. Everyone knows. They're sworn to secrecy, all that kind of garbage, okay? Girlfriends involved, like we talked about before. I mean, they do. They do break it. I see it all the time in my area where someone would give information on it. You know, because all you want, initially, all you want that person is to tell you, he's the guy that did it, and he did it along with Jose. Jose Espinada, or whatever it is. And you go on from there. You build your case that way. And, you know, that's the way to get this whole thing done. It's kind of surprising, though, after 7 years that, you know, when you got a whole laundry list of people that probably know, including
so at this point, would it make sense, though, Vito, if she were to maybe get, you know, a private eye that would want to just go and interview everybody off a list and try to see if you know, we'd send you, but you're too busy.
Well, the private eye thing, usually for most cases, I would say yes. This one, I would say probably no, only because a private eye can't offer anybody anything on this case. You see what I mean? You know, you could go and try to dig in the whole bit, but, you know, a private eye on a matter of this when it deals with gangs, you know, you got to be able to give something back if you want to make a deal with somebody, and you can't do that as a private eye. You can't make any money exchange with any witness or anything of that nature.
Right.
Bonnie, have you been threatened since, you know, I mean, you've been out there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, we deal with it as it comes. I have to tell you the circumstance behind why I'm pushing so hard for justice. Lacey didn't die right away. We were thankful and grateful enough to be got some time with her, and she was in intensive care, and she was dying. But I had promised her that I would raise her little girl, and also she was a single mom. She had a little girl who turned 3 years old on the day she was killed, and I held her hand, and I told her I'd get justice for her. Well, as a mother, that's all you can do, you know. It's the last thing you can do. So, you know,
and you're doing
obviously,
it. I mean, you're doing it.
Yeah,
you know,
you're out there.
And you've got two other women with you who are, you know, of the same mindset, who are doing
right.
the same thing. And
right.
for other mothers and parents out there. And like you said, you're raising, how old is she now? She's 10 years old?
She's 10. She's 10 now.
And you know, I'm sure if Lacey were here, she would love her as much as you do and tell her how proud she was of her at 10 years old. And that, you know, no matter what, her mother's always in her heart, and she never leaves her heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is true.
Bonnie?
Yeah.
Denny here. We've got two questions I'd like to ask. One is from the chat room, and it goes to the Wings of Protection. Both
yeah.
of them do, in fact. The question from the chat room is, what do police agencies consider a victim's family? Like, what status or what clout do they have to the police agency? The chat room question was, are they considered like, you know, special interest parties or type thing, or do they have an elevated place with the police agency?
Well, in California, actually it's case by case depending on which detective you get, depending how much information he's willing to share, he or she is willing to share. But the actual reality of it is, and this is a sad reality, in California, when a crime is committed and a person is arrested, it is now the state against that defendant. The victim's family really has no place in the system. And, you know, it's by the good graces of judges if the victim's family is allowed in the courtroom for the trial or any of it, but it becomes the state against the defendant. And then you have to worry about all the defendant's rights, those kind of things.
And
so the family isn't allowed in there?
Well, it's up to the judge, actually. It depends if they have a neat little trick that defense attorneys can do, the defendant's attorney can do, and he can pull a family member on his witness list. And if that family member or family's on the witness list, it has to go through a judge to be clear to allow that person in because they're possible to testify.
I don't understand that at all.
I don't get that because
you know the family usually makes the victim impact statement at sentencing and
you're allowed to do that at that point, but I mean to actually sit throughout the trial or to be allowed in the courtroom, it is.
But if you're not there at the crime scene, I don't understand why you would be banned or barred from not attending the trial.
Well, my whole concept of it is this was your loved one to start with. Why would you be alienated at any point in time? Detectives tend to alienate you for a good reason, actually. Whatever they share with you can't, and it's made public, basically, being shared with a victim's family, then therefore can't be used in court. So they tend to hold a lot of their information tight to the best.
Again, you weren't at the crime scene, so Vito, I don't know. I guess I just don't see how that would.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, but, you know, if that's their ruling there.
That's how they do.
Parents, the families of the victim and the offenders have some connection, so there may have been a history. So therefore, there's some questioning that can be done by the defense counsel on past relationships of the deceased and the suspect. So they make then the family members a potential witness for the defense's side. If they're going to be a witness, they can't be in the trial.
Right, absolutely. They can't witness.
And it's a ploy many times, but in some cases there are relationships.
Well, yes, a lot of domestic violence cases, things like that, yes, there are.
Another question, Bonnie, is, and let's talk about when you're contacting police agencies on behalf of someone else. Generally speaking, I realize that each department is probably different and each detective is different and so forth. But generally speaking, when you come in as an advocate like that, what kind of treatment do you experience? Do they welcome your calls? Do you get the feeling they just as soon not hear from you? Or what is your treatment by law enforcement?
Well, to tell you the truth, I've really never had a bad experience with law enforcement. The closest thing you could say that I would consider bad is that they don't share the information, which I already know that they can't. A lot of times by the time Wings of Protection steps in and does that, a lot of times the families have already been upset and alienated, you know, between them and the department.
And I would think your role is bigger with the victim's advocate office, the DA's office, that they're more supportive of you there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, they are.
Because you can do more than the coloring book they hand out when they give you the instructions, or the DA gives the instructions of what's going to happen and what you need to do. And, you know, it makes a big difference when somebody's been through it. It makes a big difference when you can tell the family what's going to happen. Well, you know, the continuances, the motions, what does this mean? And you're right there with them. And the victim advocates sometimes who are in the offices don't have that knowledge. And they can't calm the family down like you would be able to.
Well, that's true.
The other interesting thing is, and problem is, that you only get a victim advocate when there's an offender charged. If you have a case where the suspect is not identified, charged, and is unknown, there is no assistance for that family.
That's right.
No.
And so organizations like Bonnie's and we had in here in New Mexico Survivors of Homicide, we at least can fill that void for those families where there is no offender charged. And the victim advocates, when there are offenders, do provide as much help as possible, but you do get more from organizations such as Bonnie.
Well, that's true. We sister with several organizations throughout the valley here in California, and we're able to direct, you know, families to where they, you know, if they need a particular thing, like they're looking to put up a billboard, per se, or different things, we're able to help them connect with, you know, different agencies that can and do that. Or, you know, depending on what they need, you know, at the time. It just goes on individual cases. You
Everything's case by case, and that's what's so important, because you can't treat these like they're all the same, like you're putting a Band-Aid on some boo-boo. That doesn't work.
Well, in a sense, it is the same, because we're all in the same boat. I mean,
you see how you deal with them, low profile. Some people have different issues and different things, and you know, I think that what you do is you kind of go into the, you know, the sense of what's going on, and you talk to them perhaps differently than you would somebody else, and you deal with them differently. Plus the different counties and things, everybody's different. Some counties, I know that when I go into certain counties, you know, it's either they run the other way or I try to, and you know, it's the system is very different, and no county operates the same. No prosecutor, no officer.
No, actually they don't.
No, but when they see you coming, I think also what's very important for the listeners to know is that it's not about them seeing you coming. It's about the effectiveness. Somebody's watching what's going on. Somebody's monitoring. Somebody is being the documenter in a way, the witness to perhaps a proceeding that might go another way, perhaps if you weren't there. And I think that's important.
Susan, but still in the police departments across the country, they're not used to these groups, you know, whatever they are, you know, that are seeking the justice or you know, that kind of stuff. They're not used to that. They don't understand what is actually going on. across the country where these groups are looking to find Mary Smith or justice for this one or that. They look on it still with some apprehension because they don't know anything about it. You know, cops, by and large, to be honest with you, they don't watch Nancy Grace. You know, Nancy Grace is 90% truthfully a woman's show. I appear on there, but I'm just, you know, cops don't like it. They don't so obviously they don't know about these things. So somebody walks into headquarters and say, here, I'm here for justice for Mary. You know, Mary Smith, the one that died, blah, blah, blah. And they don't, this is the first time they're ever hearing of these type of things. What do you guys do? You know, that kind of a thing.
But you're right. But, I used to tease and when I would go into the courtrooms, because I did a lot of this, they would know why I was there. They would know, they would probably not have very nice names for me sometimes, but they would know, you know, it was a way to hold, again, the system accountable. But they knew why I was there. They knew who needed what, and sometimes it wasn't very nice. It when I would be in an elevator, or somebody would say, you know, you're prettier in person. You want to stay that way? They would whisper in my ear, come forward and whisper in my ear. They were very upset because maybe it was officer that I was, you know, putting away, or you know, somebody that did something and that was one of their buddies, and they didn't like that. So I applaud you, Bonnie, because it's very, very, very difficult.
Bonnie, very quickly, the segment flew by here. But just before we run out of time, I just want to verify one last time your email, NICHA3@AOL.com, correct?
Okay, NICHA3@AOL.com.
Okay,
again,
I left the I out.
NICHA3@AOL.com.
NICHA3. Thank you very, very much, Bonnie Gies. And the best of luck in your effort to get justice for Lacey. I certainly wish you nothing but the best, and thanks so much for what you do to help others.
Well,
thank you
for having me.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Thank you, guys.
Good night, Bonnie.
You know, we have a new addition to Crime Wire, and I'd like to just give her a little bit of a formal introduction. In 1994, Monica Quezon founded the not-for-profit Q Center for Missing Persons, which focuses on finding the missing, advocating for their causes, and supporting their families, offering a wide range of free services. Q has since helped more than 8,700 families in what is often the most confusing and desperate times of their lives. In addition to providing services for the missing and their families, Q offers college internships and youth mentoring programs. Q is entirely donation-funded and staffed by volunteers, including Monica Quezon, who takes no salary from the organization. We welcome Monica Quezon as the newest member to the Crime Wire team and a consultant. So we needed to, you know, do that because she has been an amazing advocate.
Wow.
For people across the country, and we welcome her to the show.
Wow, you know, Susan, 8,700. Our listeners need to understand how many people they have tried to help over there.
I think that number's a little low, actually. I think it's a hell of a lot more than that. But
that is an incredible amount, and that, you know, kudos for them. That is super. That is super, super. Wow. Well, that's a good addition, I think, right, Denny?
Yeah, you got it. I'm very excited about it. I happened to have the opportunity to attend one of the Q events a few weeks ago, and was very impressed with them and their operation, and I echo what you said.
You met her, Denny? You actually met her?
Yes, I did have that pleasure.
Wow, very good. Excellent. Well, that'll be a welcome addition to us, that's for sure. Well, we're going to move on to another case. It's called the Brian Sullivan case. Interesting case. We want all our listeners to listen to this. In Gate, New York, Brian Sullivan disappeared early in the morning of July the 8th, 2007. According to reports, the 19-year-old Churchville Chili High graduate had spent the previous evening watching a movie at a friend's house, then bought breakfast at the drive-thru of a Chili Avenue Burger King. Investigators found a receipt for the food stamped with the time of 5:38 a.m. in Brian's car. Brian's car was a red 1995 Pontiac Sunfire, and that was found in front of a 100-acre wooded area on nearby Leadington Avenue. He has not been seen or heard from since. Joining us tonight is his mother, Barbara Sullivan. Barbara, welcome to Crime Wire.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure to have you on here. The first question that came to mind to me when I was reading this 100-acre wooded area, okay, is there any kind of pond, lake, or anything on that of that nature?
It's an old dolomite area. It's like 100 acres of, like, really rough terrain, and there's I got all flustered here. I've never done this. It's a dolomite area. I don't know if you know what dolomite is. I'm sure you do. It's like concrete or something, and there's like,
I truthfully didn't know. That's why I was listening to you.
Okay.
I didn't know what that meant, to be honest with you.
It's like they used to use this area for the dolomite mines, I guess, and they still, there is still some stuff that goes on there, but it's like there's nothing that would ever or could ever be developed there, I don't think. And it's just 100 acres of thick woods and...
Right. Now, what has the police told you about their search of that? Do you know if they've gone through it all, half of it, a third of it? What do you know as far as them searching that area?
Well, they did do a couple of searches in the beginning. We, of course, searched because we, you know, that's where the car was. So before the police really got involved, we as family members did. But there's no way that we would even been able to do anything in that area. And then the police did a couple of small searches, and then they did a big search with a search and rescue team, and they didn't come up with anything. You know, they haven't come up with anything there. And so
that is a lot of acres when you're dealing with 100 acres. Now, I mean, is there pathways, or is this deeply wooded, very tough to get through?
It is deeply wooded, but there is like one little path that goes off right where the circle where his car was found. But then it really doesn't, then it just kind of breaks off into these big, thick woods and things. So it's not really like paths through it, per se, that you could just walk through the whole thing.
Now, Barbara, let me ask you, before that night, did your son ever take off before like this? Where maybe meet a girl or do something where he just disappeared for a day or two? Never?
Maybe a day, but I would have been able to get a hold of him.
Okay.
On his phone. I mean, I may not have seen him for a day, but that I can't even really, not even a 24-hour period where I didn't see him, no.
Okay. And as far as the vehicle, was things missing from there that you knew of when the police checked it after the vehicle was found?
No, he does have his...
I mean, did he leave his wallet in the car by any chance?
The wallet was in the car, but that was not unusual for Brian to leave his wallet in his car.
Was there money still in it?
No, his cash card, he always carried his cash card in his pocket.
Okay.
That is, we believe, is still with him. But as far as the wallet, that was just sitting on the front seat.
Okay. Did he have a girlfriend at that time?
Not that we know of.
No.
No.
Okay.
You know what? Why don't we bring Monica Quezon in from the Q Center? You know, Monica, welcome, and thank you for everything that you're doing for all these families. When you're contacted, let's just for the listeners at the beginning, when you're contacted, what is the first step that you're going to do when a Barbara Sullivan contacts you and says, I need help? What's the process of the agency?
Well, the first thing we did, of course, is get him properly registered, and we had a lot of questions, you know, and try to verify that information. The investigators and law enforcement in that community is very supportive. The area, so you can get a better vis of it, is like if you come out of Burger King, you come through basically a residential kind of wide open area, if you will, of like homes or what have you, and you're going to turn down a paved road that ends in a dirt gravel cul-de-sac. And it's, you know, a place that, you know, where people might have gone and parked and made out or what have you and that type of thing. And when she talks about paths, there is a path or two, but there is passage. You know, if any good searcher can get through that kind of stuff. But there is a lot of thicket and briar and that type of stuff. But the first thing, you know, is what I've done is we've collected all the information in her case. We went up there, and I immediately had them bring me out to the area, and I started shooting GPS coordinates, and I've been looking at the different scenarios and gathering the information about him being at Burger King and where we thought he might would go and where's home and where's this relation or where he was coming from and those type of things. And that's where we're at right now, trying to basically go back, start from the beginning, and, you know, he's got to be somewhere there. And that's what we're going to do. And then we hope to, you know, to kind of renew the efforts in the search for him and try to bring in some different resources to the, you know, the game of, you know, the hunt for looking for him. And, you know, I do believe they've done a good job. Can it be, can something be looked over again? Absolutely. I think that, you know, 100 acres needs to be gone over more than one or two times with multiple resources. I think that there's other areas to look at as well, and I think that, you know, you just have to kind of, if you eliminate that area, you have to span your horizon out, if you will, looking at the case in general, and that's pretty much what we're in the process of doing right now. We do want to redo some efforts, but we also want to expand and look what's around, and I spent some quality time, a couple hours with Barb and her husband and, you know, asking them a lot of one-on-one questions and like I said, shooting coordinates and physically seeing different areas and kind of hearing the story as we drive along. And that helps me a lot to get a perception of what happened back then and what's going on now and that type of thing.
Well, good information, Monica, very good information. Pat Caristo, what are you feeling on this case? Anything jump out at you?
I would ask a couple of questions, and I'm sure that other people have, but this would be my thought. The area where the car was found, is that car known to law enforcement as a place where incidents happen, where other vehicles have been dropped off? Is it a crime area?
I don't think it's considered a crime area. I think there's kids have gone back there and have been known to go in there and party, but I don't think that it's like a crime area. You know,
well,
I mean,
my thinking is if it was, then that would take you to one place. But if it isn't, then I would say there are some leads to follow there. Because
yeah, it's not a crime area, but it's definitely an area young people might go to make out.
Right. So somebody was familiar with it and left it there.
Correct.
Left the car there. I assume they processed the car for fingerprints and all of that.
Yes.
And where did they find unidentified prints, or was the car wiped clean?
From myself and my husband. Before we even knew that, you know, anything was wrong, we had cleaned the car. We thought that Brian had gone because we had told him he had to get a job or he had to sign up to school or get a job. And we didn't, you know, we kind of thought that he had a deadline, that he just was going to leave and then, like, in a couple of days call us or something. And he didn't.
Yeah, and not only that, the things that you have listed here that makes it strange that he would have left on his own, I guess this car was recently bought, it says. All of his clothing he left and $1,000 worth of new sound recording equipment. Is that correct? That was still in the box.
Yes, and he had money in the bank and plus a couple of checks sitting on his dresser for, you know, a good amount of money. And,
right.
Has anybody checked to see if during that time in the last, around the time that he vanished, that other people in the area, there were other similar cases or something that might be suspicious, similar to the way that Brian disappeared?
You mean other people going missing?
Yes.
No, there's no.
And Barbara,
I know you go ahead.
Barbara, let me just ask you this question. The Burger King, would he be up usually that time in the morning? Was that some place that maybe he frequented a lot, that someone that was watching him would follow him from there or something?
Well, you know, I mean, We don't know. I mean, has he gone to that Burger King? Absolutely. When that was shown through his bank records, because he always used his debit card, you know, to purchase anything.
Right.
So he had gone there. Now, at that time of the morning, I don't know.
Did he have a computer in your home?
Yes.
And was there maybe anything perhaps a couple of days before? Did somebody check? Did he get an email? Was there some correspondence? Were you able to check on that as well?
They took the computer and they went through the whole computer.
And they didn't find anything?
No.
Hey, Denny Griffin, what are you feeling on this?
I was going to ask this question. During this just over 3 years that have gone by, have the police ever said they had a specific theory, or did they ever think they had some kind of a lead that might break the case, or has it been kind of, no activity or no real hot prospects for resolution?
Yes, no. They tell us that they're investigating it as if he's with us still, and that is if he's not.
Monica, what's your feeling on this? I mean, I know you,
well,
you know.
There was a lot of missed opportunity and no fault to anyone, just not knowledge. Because of the timing of his car being found, Barb and them, they clean things up, just like a lot of people have done laundry, and we say, no, don't do laundry. Don't let people in the missing person's bedroom. We might need to run a live scent dog, but they already did that because people out of stress, they start doing stuff, especially families. So, where we were would have hoped that maybe there would have been some kind of clue in the car or, a fiber or a fingerprint. I think that opportunity was lost, and I think that's why it was kind of hard to start with. All you had was the place of the car, which, that's where you start to search. I think something happened to him. I think earlier that night he was possibly at a party or been around some people. Maybe something happened, and it kind of flowed over to Burger King. To not an altercation there about maybe someone seeing him again and then, hey, do you want to go down here to meet for a minute or something and something going awry, or even at the party something went awry and his car was brought there.
Talk for a minute, will you, if you will, about just overall in general about when a family contacts you, as quick as possible, what should they do and not do when they have items of importance or they want to go ahead and clean something and do something.
They need to secure it like a crime scene. They need to, if they have a bedroom, the person lives at home, they need to shut the door and not let anyone in it, nobody.
No, and don't clean it. Tell them how important it is not to clean it.
Leave the clothes dirty. Leave the car dirty. Leave everything just as it is, because that dirty clothes, you can utilize for a live scent dog. The dirty clothes you can use for DNA, hairbrushes, toothbrushes, things of that sort. The last thing you want to do is touch anything. You treat it just like, it is a crime scene. And we're actually, getting ready to put out some new information of the do's and don'ts for families and also the do's and don'ts of, like, when people contact you and things of that sort, just to help families as a guide. But, that's the first thing families do. They stress. They know the police are coming or whatever. They want to clean up. They don't want their kid's room being a mess or whatever. Or, they stress and they look for clues themselves. And in the process of that, they could possibly damage evidence that the police, are especially trained to clue into the forensic part. They might have just, lost every opportunity there. And nowadays we have such great technology that the best thing to do is do nothing. Don't touch anything. Don't move anything. And if you like that car should have been left there in a live scent dog and other, see if you could get a track and, whatever. There's so many things that, you can get off the initial scene.
We didn't think
different circumstances that happened. That's all.
His room, we didn't touch his room or anything, and the police went through that, but not with a dog or anything. But they did go through his room. But as far as, the car, we had to move the car because they were going to tow it. They were going to leave it because they figured he was just going to come back. Well, we did, too. He's just going to come back. And the next day when he didn't come back to get the car, I said to my husband, well, we better tow it because I don't want it impounded and have fees and all this and that. And I wish I would have.
Which at the time I would have loved to see law enforcement say, don't touch it. They're not going to tow it.
and let's get some dogs and people out here. And the police actually should have removed that car and brought it to impound. You know what I'm saying? And they should have, you know, there should have been a lot done that. And it's only because of different circumstances that unfolded that that opportunity was lost. It's not a total loss. You know, I think every missing person can still be found, but it's because that vital information was lost at the initial onset. The only place you had to do is to search out there, because that's the last known place that that person could have been or should have been or was connected to something that was there, which was the vehicle. But, you know, it's just, there, like so many other cases, such a mystery, and you just, you know, you have to keep on with the public attention, you know, seeking that tip. And you know, people ask me all the time, you know, how can you get a tip 10 years from now and 15 years later? But people do. People talk. People finally come forward. And you can. And cases are being solved every day to prove that.
Go ahead,
Vito. Can I ask another question about that Brian was watching a movie with friends and then he went to get food? Is the friend okay? Has he been checked out? And when the food, the results for the food, was it for one person or more than one?
Okay. The movie that he had gone to watch, we know until 11 o'clock at night. His friend's mother left, and he was at the brother's. Okay, he was at his, this is just hard to explain. He was at his friend's uncle's house. His friend wasn't there, but the uncle was, and the mother, his friend's mother, which has been, he's known her for 20 years. She left at 11, thinking Brian was going to spend the night there, and as far as we know, he did. He spent the night there. We don't know if he, because the friend was sleeping, or the brother was sleeping, so we don't know if Brian left then, a little after Dawn had left, you know, after the mom had left, or did he leave in the morning? And then as far as the food, he ordered for one person, and
okay.
There was only one person in the car because that he went through the drive-thru, and the woman spoke to him because he had asked her a question about cinnamon buns or something, so she remembered, you know, speaking to him. Plus, it was, you know, 5:30 in the morning. Probably not too much business that time.
So it sounds like he left the friend's house that early and he was on his way maybe home?
Where he would have went to get something to eat, and then we lived right down that road, probably 15 minutes down, you know, on that same road. Say.
Go ahead, Vito.
Monica brought up an interesting point at the beginning of the conversation. We can't have tunnel vision on this. That car could have been driven there by the bad guys, and something could have happened at a different spot. They know this is a 100-acre place, good place to ditch a car. Maybe it wouldn't be found as quick as a Walmart parking lot. So the crime may not have occurred actually at that location.
Right. And I think I can't remember right off the bat. Was it that day, Barb, that the car was found? Wasn't it called in or something?
It was called in, I think, around between 10 and 11 in the morning.
It wasn't a long period of time, and that's what's really puzzling. It's like, you know, so you've got a window basically at 5:30 a.m.
Five hours.
I mean, it's not a large window, but obviously can be a large window in any crime, but... You know, I've had a lot. I've had days, you know, where before a car has been found. So I don't know. It's just, it's a bizarre case, and I'm still, you know, like I said, gathering information and being there physically, seeing the area. It's like, you know, there's no way. I really do think that if he would have been out there in those woods, even though they do need to be looked over, you know, and keep going over them type of thing, you know, the kind of setup with the neighborhood and the community watch and different things going on out there, you know, it would appear that, and, you know, forgive me, if he's deceased out there, buzzards would have been flying within a week and somebody would have called it in knowing at this point that this child's missing, you know. So that's one thing that makes me feel a little bit better that, you know, he's probably not out there either. And then the fact that the police did do a large-scale and a small-scale search out there. But, you know, from Burger King to this area, and it does appear that he would have been on his way home, you know, what happened? You know, who did he run into? You know, was it something that came from another day or something that happened? And these are all questions that can't seem to be answered. So it's like he almost vanished. And then, you know, because of what happened, I mean, I just don't think he's going to walk away and leave his car. I don't think Barb thinks that is.
No.
I mean, it wasn't like this altercation. It was like, look, you know, you need to grow up a little bit, get a job and stuff, you know. And,
yeah.
And you know.
We were joking about it.
Like and you were,
yeah.
You were close to him, Barbara, weren't you? You were
yes.
close enough to him.
Yes. But
and
we were,
so your...
you know, joking about it. I'd
what about
say,
a camera
okay.
outside at the drive-in at Burger King? Did
there
camera?
Was now. Now, if there was one, it wasn't working. I don't think it was working. And it seems
and
to
that's too in America. It's like all these places have
yeah.
cameras.
How many,
well,
let's talk
free.
About
yeah,
that for a second. How the hell can all these apartment buildings, businesses, and then when something happens, Vito, we say, what do you mean if it wasn't working? Where's their
right.
accountability? You can't falsely put up security and not have it running, can you?
Oh, yeah. No,
yeah.
No. We just had a big major assault case where a victim was punched and he fell, banged his head, and died. And basically what we did is we canvassed probably about 30 places, high-rise office building, everything. We stood on the spot where the person fell and looked in every direction and just hit every single place just to see who had cameras, parking garages, everything. That's what needs to be done, obviously, in any type of a case, you know?
Right. But if you have a camera as a business owner, you would just, it's almost that you assume responsibility.
That's right.
To provide that footage. And that's my anger because I can tell you, I would say a good 80% of the cases I run into annually, there's cameras. And if we'd have those cameras, we'd know something. But, oh, yeah, that camera's been broke for 2 years or...
don't you pay insurance?
Or whatever.
I mean, what the hell? I mean, the businesses should be liable. When they put this stuff
yeah.
up, when you're, again, a business like that, a Burger King, that's a franchise. When you rent an apartment, how many times have we gone into crime scenes? All of us. And you go and look and go, you point to the camera and say, okay, is it running? Well, no, we don't have enough. We just didn't do it. There's no battery. They should be charged.
Yeah, because it's part of their sales pitch, too, even in apartments. So we have a up-to-date security system and things of that sort. You know, and a lot of times they're not running. And a lot of businesses and even some of the large chains that we think, you know, have cameras, a lot of them are dummy cameras or a lot of them are not working. And they know they're not working, and they've known for a while. And like I said, they do need to take some kind of responsibility. Frustrating to go and have six businesses that have cameras and only one you know, might have film, but then, you know, someone forgot to reload it or whatever, or copied over it, or so many days went by or what have you. There just needs to be more of accountability and everybody getting on the same page. You know, keep your footage for 30 days because not everything comes forth in 3 days, you
That's
know?
That's right. That's right.
You know, and make sure if you do have cameras that it's not so grainy you can't even make out a white truck. We just did a case down in Georgia. We sat there for hours and could not even finger a white truck at night. Come on.
Did Brian
and
have
it
a
was
cell
so
phone?
Bad. Yes.
Where was did they never recovered the cell phone?
No, and it goes right to voicemail. And
Page,
did right
were
away.
They able to
so
check anything?
Probably
no.
It's the phone had died because both the chargers were in the car as well. Oh my God, the cat just jumped on me. The charger for it was in, he had one that went in the car, and that was in the car. So, but it's the phone.
Can I ask you, how did the media, did the local media give the case much coverage at all, or no?
Well, we've had okay coverage. I'd say okay, fair, of course. I don't, you know, who thinks
Let
that
me
they have enough?
That now.
Pardon me?
I said, let me answer that, no.
No.
Yeah.
They don't do that for these cases. You guys know that. They don't, you know, when somebody goes, especially, you know, with your son's age and everything, they just don't take it into account that it was important enough. And they go, well, you know, maybe he left or did this or did that. I'm tired of that as well. People just don't take off the way that they want to. To me, that's laziness. But they did do something, but it wasn't enough.
I hope that's our hope and pray that he did take off. You know, I mean, we can't rule that out, but that's what we hope for every day.
Okay,
for some reason, you know.
We are out of time. If anybody has any information, it's the Monroe County Sheriff. The number is 585-753-4177 or 585-753-4177. Or you can email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Again, thank you very much to Barbara Sullivan, Monica Quezon from the Q Center. Thank you to our CrimeWire team, research producer Kim Colton, and public relations team at Imagine Publicity, Delilah. Our next show will be Tuesday, September 28th, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
And thank you all for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show at www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night and God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Susan Murphy Milano, Pat Caristo, and Monica Quezon. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.